All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be included in such a great list of speakers here, such a productive workshop. The story I'm going to tell today is about applying the ideas of Grassmannian geometry beyond the case of planar theories with maximum supersymmetry. And it's based on, most of the results are based on these two papers, and is related to a lot of the work that has been talked about today. But I want to set the stage, as everybody here knows very well, there's been tremendous progress in our understanding of scattering amplitudes and our ability to compute things in perturbation theory. And some of these things, for example, we now have these all-loop recursion relations, at least for some theories. There's unitarity-based methods, just a plug for the paper that appeared today, the three-loop amplitude, where every single coefficient here, this is a closed formula for any amplitude at three loops in planar maximum supersymmetry, where the coefficient is a picture like this, such as these. And of course, there's also the amplituhedron, which we've heard a lot about today, and the positive Grassmannian, which we've also heard about today. But of all of these different frameworks, well, first of all, these frameworks are all unified together in the case of theories in four dimensions with massless particles. And of all of the different new tools that have emerged in the last few years, the one which is unquestionably the most general and most robust is the oldest, and it's what led to everything else on the page, which is this unitarity-based method, which is the idea that you can determine perturbative scattering amplitudes to any order by computing by their cuts. So these pictures correspond to cuts of two-loop amplitudes, and that these pictures represent the coefficients of some poly logarithms and things, and you can determine the any perturbative scattering amplitudes by knowing this kind of data. And provided there are some caveats about d dimensions and things like that, it's been known for a while that this data, this collection of cuts, represents complete information about perturbation theory in any quantum field theory, in any number of dimensions, whatever, by unitarity. And so these represent a very general class of things that are well-defined in any quantum field theory. And there's something very magical about what these functions look like, what these cut pictures look like, and their form in four-dimensional theories with massless particles. And that's what this talk is really about. It's not about scattering amplitudes, but more about these pictures. So, and to set the stage, kind of the big picture summary for this talk, or what I want everybody to come away with, is that there exists a very powerful correspondence. All the magic about four-dimensional theories of massless particles is because of some correspondence, or at least can be explained in terms of some correspondence. So this is what one of these cut pictures looks like. You can imagine it as some residue of some four-loop amplitude if you'd like, but I'll define it in terms of by first principles in a few slides. You don't need to know anything about that right now. The important thing is that whatever this thing is, this physically important function for perturbation theory, can be represented for any theory in four dimensions of massless particles as some integral over some auxiliary Grassmannian manifold C. And this correspondence has some immediate and some powerful implications. So first, what the correspondence looks like is that for every picture like this, which is some coefficient of some polylogarithm or it's some, some function that's relevant to perturbation theory, we're going to draw the pictures of on-shell diagrams. For every diagram like this, there exists some submanifold of some Grassmannian with some volume form that depends on the theory and the diagram and all sorts of things. And this correspondence teaches us a lot of things in both directions. In particular, it tells you that volume-preserving diffeomorphisms on the right correspond to physical symmetries. It's easy to see they leave the functional form invariant, and I'm going to call them trivial symmetries because they're two-term identities, but they're highly non-trivial in the sense that diffeomorphisms are infinite-dimensional, and so you immediately learn that these cuts, these functions in quantum field theory, have infinite-dimensional symmetries in a great generality for four-dimensional theories of massless particles. This raises a lot of interesting questions. The purpose of this talk, I'm going to really focus on these kinds of non-planar pictures, but I just want to give you some basic familiarity with what these things look like. For a planar theory with maximum supersymmetry, the graphs in question can be drawn on a plane. They're two colored graphs, and they're not oriented. So they're undirected planar graphs. These strata look something like this, and the volume forms are couldn't possibly be simpler. These are called positroid varieties, and we basically know everything about this, in part because there exists a combinatorial classification of everything on both sides. So we have enormously powerful tools to really answer everything we could possibly want to know about this particular quantum field theory. But as soon as you get away from maximum supersymmetry or planarity, things get a little bit more different, but the ingredients don't change all that much. And these infinite dimensional symmetries are the Yang-Yin, which of course is an important symmetry. If you have planar theory without supersymmetry, the only change in the story is that you get some prefactor that depends on the orientation of the graph. They're now directed graphs. And as soon as you have non-planar theory with maximum supersymmetry, same kinds of volume forms. And they're no longer positroid varieties, but they are cluster varieties. And just to be clear for the mathematicians in the audience, what I'm defining as an on-shell cluster variety is the image of the left-hand side on the right-hand side. Whether or not that's onto or not is an open question. For a theory that's non-planar without supersymmetry, with some n equals n super Yang-Mills, you just multiply these things by prefactors that depend on the orientation. Okay, so this correspondence allows us to see and to start to answer some extremely important questions for both mathematics and physics. For example, I will show in a few slides, you'll see later on, that on very general grounds, the number of essentially distinct functions is finite for any process, to all loop orders. This is amazing. So you can reconstruct infinite loop perturbation theory with a finite list of functions. That's pretty incredible. But how many are there? How do you name them? How do you classify them? What are the relations, et cetera? What functional relations do they satisfy? What are these infinite dimensional symmetries, and do they have anything to do with symmetries of amplitudes? I don't know. And do these functions include simultaneously integrals over kinematics, including integrals that you might imagine as a basis for the loop expansion? And so you might wonder if you can express loop amplitudes directly in terms of these pictures, which you can in planar n equals 4. So what you should know probably already, if you're in this audience, is that for the case of planar maximum supersymmetry, we understand how to answer all of these questions. And it's beautiful, and it's combinatorial, and we basically understand everything. And as soon as you step away from planarity or maximum supersymmetry, this correspondence exists, but we know next to nothing about any of these questions. And so in the first half of this talk, I'm going to motivate and derive for you this correspondence constructively for any four-dimensional theory of massless particles. And then I will, in this last half, I will show you how much we know for non-planar theories with maximum supersymmetry, which is not very much, but it took a lot of work. Okay, and in the first part, especially towards the review here, especially about the kinematical review, for those of you in the audience for whom it's not already completely familiar, it's probably irrelevant, so I will go quickly through most of that. Okay. So while, of course, these pictures were first relevant to physicists as cuts of loop amplitudes and used to reconstruct something, they don't need to be defined with respect to some off-shell thing like the loop integrand. They can be defined from first principles by answering a very simple question. What is the space of functions we're allowed to talk about that are free of any unphysical degrees of freedom? And of course, one function that's well-defined, that makes no reference to virtual particles or ghosts or gauge redundancies, is our scattering amplitudes. So the S matrix is, of course, one of these physically meaningful functions. But the important thing is that if you just knew any S matrices whatsoever, you could build up from these a much broader class of physically meaningful functions without reference to virtual particles or anything like that. In particular, you could glue two of them together. Now, of course, historically, a picture like this, you might, if depending on your intuition, you might think, you can define this as the residue of some Feynman, sum of Feynman diagrams, but the important thing is that the functional meaning of a picture like this is dictated by first principles of quantum mechanics. See, for this internal particle, it's a physical state, it's on shell. And as a physical state, locality dictates that it can, well, this particle can travel arbitrary distances in space and time, and so these amplitudes must be independent. So locality dictates we multiply them together. And unitarity dictates we sum over a complete set for all unobserved states. So we have to sum over them, which means integrating over their on-shell phase space and summing over all their other quantum labels, like color or helicity or anything else. And I hope you can appreciate that this is defined in d dimensions. Massless, massive, doesn't matter. And it immediately extends to arbitrary graphs of scattering amplitudes. So a general Onshell function is some network, some diagram, where you multiply every amplitude of every vertex and you integrate over the Onshell phase space of every internal line. And these things are well defined in a completely general quantum field theory. They're not as nice as in four dimensions, but they're well defined. And one thing that you might want, one simple characteristic about these things, which might be good to have in the back of your mind, is what kind of a function is it? Is it a function? Is it a rational function? Or is it a distribution? Or is it an integral or something like that? Because we've got a lot of integrals here, and every amplitude has momentum conservation in it. So one way to see that is just to count how many delta functions are there. And of course, you have a momentum conservation for every single vertex. So you have d constraints at every vertex, for each vertex. And you have d minus 1 phase space integrals for every internal line from the integration of our Onshell phase space. And of course, so this is the total number of delta functions in this object on the right-hand side. But it's natural, because any graph of momentum-conserving vertices conserves momentum across the entire graph, it's natural to mod out by overall momentum conservation. And when this thing is, this counts the number of excess delta functions. And if it's 0, we're talking about an ordinary rational function. If it's positive, we have some constraints. And if it's negative, we have some integrations to do. So it unifies this, not just the cuts, the coefficients of loop amplitudes, but also maybe loop integrands, certainly the residues of loop amplitudes all at the same time. But to say anything more concretely and to really expose what's special about massless theories in four dimensions, we need to restrict our attention to massless theories in four dimensions. And the nice way of doing that is of course, in terms of spinner helicity variables, which I will review very briefly because, again, everybody in this audience either knows it or doesn't need to know it. So the basic idea is to write, instead of four vectors for the momenta of the particles involved, you write it as the, you notice that the determinant of this matrix is 0 for massless particles, so you write it as an outer product of a pair of two vectors, these spinners. And I'll skip over a lot of this stuff. Lorentz invariants are constructed as determinants of these spinners. And so the basic kinematical data is not d-dimensional momenta with a constraint that they're on shell, but it's much nicer to talk about a pair of two vectors, modulo this, the action of the little group, scaling one and by something and lambda tilde by the inverse. I expect everybody in this audience is very familiar with all of this. And again, if you're not, doesn't matter. But the real purpose of leaving this slide in the talk is because I want to introduce a little notation on the next page. So the kinematical data that of which an amplitude is a function is describable by a pair of 2 by n matrices, this lambda and lambda tilde, which we can think of, if I don't write indices, I mean collectively the whole matrix. And if I write an upper index, I mean the row, the n vector, the row here. Or I can think about them, of course, as n column vectors, which is probably the obvious way of thinking about it. But because Lorentz transformations mix up the rows of each of the matrices, and because the little group allows for rescaling, the little group invariant content of the kinematical data is not really these matrices, but really the Grassmannian. So for lambda, it's the span of these two n-dimensional rows, which is a little unusual way of thinking about it, but Lorentz. So what I mean more concretely is that these are a pair of rows in n dimensions, so they're two vectors. And Lorentz transformations let us rotate by SL2 on this, in this, and little group allows us to rescale. So the Lorentz invariant content is really the plane lambda, which is a 2 by n matrix modulo GL2, or it's just the span of two vectors in n dimensions. And of course, as everybody in this audience knows, that's just a secret way of motivating the definition of this more general space, or the Grassmannian, which is the span of k vectors in n dimensions, which you can think of as a k by n matrix modulo GLK. Anyway, this will play an important role later on. So the one thing, well, maybe I can skip this, but well, just for notational clarity, momentum conservation, if we take all the momenta B incoming, is the statement that all the momenta add up to 0. Which in these variables becomes lambda, lambda tilde. And just to clarify the notation that'll appear everywhere in this talk, when I write a dot here, I mean dot transpose as matrices. I really mean sum over the particle index. everywhere. Now, this has a nice geometric interpretation because what this tells you is that these two, as two planes in n dimensions, that they're orthogonal to each other. And what I mean by that is that there's a, for every k plane in n dimensions, the span of k vectors in n dimensions, there's an obvious dual, which is the space not spanned by those k vectors, and that's an n minus k plane. So there's an obvious n minus k plane for every k plane, and that means in particular lambda and lambda tilde have orthogonal complements, which are right lambda perp and lambda tilde perp. And momentum conservation tells you that as two planes in n dimensions, lambda and lambda tilde are contained within each other's complements. And this is just kind of a cute triviality with the exception of three particles. And I'm going to skip over most of this because, again, for this audience, but when you look at the three particle S matrix, you might imagine, you know, on general grounds, we'd say it's a function of lambda and lambda tilde, this pair of two planes. But as we just saw, momentum conservation tells you that these two planes have to be mutually orthogonal. They have to be in each other's complements. But a two-plane in three dimensions has a one-dimensional complement, which is so it's not possible to satisfy for general lambda and lambda tilde. And this means that the only solution to momentum conservation is that one or the other is degenerate. So in one case, either lambda tilde is completely is degenerate and spanned by this, by the complement of lambda, or vice versa. And so momentum conservation immediately breaks up into two distinct cases. And I will skip the details here and how you determine this, but as everybody, I expect most people here know, this argument leads to a unique form of the three-particle S matrix for massless particles in involving general helicities. And they break into two classes depending on what the sum of the helicities are. If the sum of the helicities is negative, you get the top line, and the sum of the helicities is positive, you get the bottom line. So these two distinct cases. And you can write these down with any in any quantum field theory with massless particles in four dimensions, including the standard model. These things are well defined. And they vanish in the limit of real momenta, but this what we're really saying here, what I'm really saying here is that they have a unique analytic continuation. Okay, so just to illustrate this, if you have just spin one particles, you can write plus and minus ones everywhere and evaluate this function, and you get this thing, which is probably familiar to a lot of people here. And this is the answer for the one minus and two pluses. And in general, whenever you have a theory that's defined with one state and its CP conjugate, it's natural to not talk about, well, to not label the pluses and minus everywhere, but just indicate the flow of helicity through the graph. And so if you just have a theory with a single kind of particle and its CP conjugate, it's more natural to instead of putting pluses and minus everywhere, to draw arrows to indicate the flow of helicity. And so we can, for Yang-Mills or super-Yang-Mills, you know, any amount of super-Yang-Mills, these are the building blocks of the theory. But of course, if you have more kinds of particles in your theory, you have to indicate which particles are involved by somehow distinguishing the lines. And so if you talked about massless QED, for example, you'd have to draw a little wavy line for a photon and straight lines. But this starts looking way too much like a Feynman diagram for my taste. But in general, these vertices, the edges of the vertices have to label the states in the theory, which require an orientation because of the particle versus CP conjugate, and it requires maybe labeling all the lines according to the specter of the theory. Something very magical happens for theories with maximum supersymmetry, and I literally mean only maximum supersymmetry, not n equals 2 or anything like that. And it's because, uniquely for maximally supersymmetric theory in four dimensions, a particle and its CP conjugate are in the same supermultiple, but they're related by supersymmetry, which means exactly for maximum supersymmetry, I don't need to draw arrows. There's a unique superfunction of this type and a unique superfunction of this type. And so this is what is special about supersymmetry, and it's only special about maximum supersymmetry. As soon as you have n equals 2, it's basically as bad. The spectrum is more or less indistinguishable in terms of these pictures from n equals 0. Okay, so out of these building blocks, you can start gluing them together and build up functions, arbitrarily complicated functions, that are well-defined gauge-invariant things in pretty much any massless theory, in any quantum field theory in four dimensions of massless particles. So here are some examples for maximum supersymmetry. It doesn't matter. But they're also well-defined for pure Yang-Mills. This is something with all plus amplitudes, something that's non-vanishing. It's a one-loop integrand in some sense. You can write it in QED. This turns out to be the tree amplitude for Compton scattering, but this is just an artifact. what I really want to emphasize is that in just complete generality, these pictures are not generally amplitudes, but they're parts of amplitudes. And it's these pictures that have a very beautiful correspondence with Grassmannian geometry. So starting with these three particle vertices, I can glue them together in some more arbitrarily complicated mess. And from the definition I've described, the product of all the vertices integrated over the on-shell phase space for all the internal particles, any precocious undergrad can multiply these things out and tell you what this function is. And in this case, it's n hat delta equals 0, which means it's just a rational function, and it's that rational function, which is either scary or nice, depending on your point of view. But the point is that it's well-defined, and so you can just ask somebody what, you know, you can put this on a computer, or you can give it to an undergrad, and they'll tell you what the function is. So the connection between these functions in Grassmannian geometry took a little while for us to really establish and to really understand. And what I want to show you now is how you might have been led to this correspondence by just trying to calculate these things efficiently, by just just trying to do it by brute force. And the first thing, if you were that undergrad given the problem of computing this thing, the first thing that you would realize that would annoy you is that momentum conservation at every three-point thing, just ordinary momentum conservation, has two solutions, right? There's the white solution and the blue solution. And so if you actually multiplied all the vertices and did this phase space integral, the solutions for the internal lines would bifurcate all over the place. And so you'd have tons and tons of possible solutions at every vertex. And of course, for the diagram in question, there's a unique solution you care about. Right, momentum conservation for three-particle vertex linearizes. It bifurcates into two linear factors, and you only care about one of the two solutions for every vertex if you know the color of the vertex. And so it would be nice to try to make the linearity of momentum conservation at a three-particle vertex manifest in the way we calculate this. And to do that, you might have discovered the Grassmannian. So the basic idea is to introduce some auxiliary junk into the problem. But it does a good thing. It makes momentum conservation linear, the linearity of momentum conservation manifest. So the basic idea is that for every blue vertex, instead of writing just this function, I'm going to introduce an auxiliary 2x3 matrix, B, and I'm going to rewrite this function in maybe a scary looking way on the right hand side. Just hold on for a moment. I'll define this and show you why it's not so bad. And for every white vertex, instead of writing this super function, you would write this. And of course, if you didn't care about n = 4, if you cared about some other quantum field theory, you just change this numerator. So this is just a well-defined thing. So let me clarify what the notation here is. This is the volume over the Grassmannian, so it's over 2x3 matrices modulo GL2. And these things in the denominator are the 2x2 minors of this matrix. And here, the 1, 2, and 3 are the 1x1 minors of that matrix. Might seem like a silly way of writing it. But what I mean in very concrete sense by this divide by vol, et cetera, is to pick a gauge. You know, this is very familiar to physicists. So you set a k by k matrix to the identity, and then this thing, then you just evaluate the rest. And so in any particular GLK chart, it's just d log d log in whatever variables remain. So in both cases, these are two-dimensional. I've introduced two auxiliary integrations, okay? And which is good, because I've introduced two extra delta functions, too. You know, I have 4 over here, and I have 6 over here. So to get from the right-hand side to the left-hand side is trivial. I just use these delta functions to do this integral and see. So what does this delta function tell us? It tells us that lambda is orthogonal to the orthogonal complement of B, which is a very convoluted way of saying that lambda contains, or B contains lambda, you know, that they're the same as a two-plane. So doing the integral using these delta functions sets b to lambda, replace b with lambda everywhere, and you get the left-hand side. And here, the two extra delta functions are easy to identify, and it tells you that w is orthogonal to lambda tilde, which again is a unique one plane in three dimensions. And you put in lambda perp, and you get the left-hand side again. So this might seem like a bit of baggage, and it really is. But what is nice about this, and the reason why this is a good idea, is because now momentum conservation, first of all, these are in the exact same form, and also momentum conservation is now linear in lambda and lambda tilde separately. And the reason why it's a Grassmannian is kind of trivial. It's because these delta functions are all linear systems of equations, and linear systems always have a GLK redundancy. You can always add and subtract rows and multiply any rows by anything, and you don't change the constraints. So anyway, this is that kind of the origin of this. Okay, so just with these two seeds, I want to show you in the next slide how to constructively build up the Grassmannian representation for any diagram you'd like. And it basically follows from two really simple building blocks. The first is so trivial, but I need to mention it, which is just multiplying two of these diagrams together. The corresponding functions just multiply. And to define the image of multiplication, you can take the k-plane in n dimensions and a k-plane in n dimensions, and you spit out a k plus, the sum of the k-planes and sum of n. And the volume forms you just take the wedge product. And d, I haven't defined yet, but d is the number of coordinates in these volume forms. It's the number of variables in the volume forms. So let me illustrate this. So if I wanted to take these two things and just multiply them together as functions, I would just take this thing and this 1x3 matrix and this 2x3 matrix, and I'd glue them together into a big 3x6 matrix. Okay? This would be the definition of the product. And the volume form is just the volume form on the left, the wedge of the volume form on the right. Very simple. So the next operation is the least trivial, and I'm not going to derive it for you, but it follows from the basic definition of how you integrate over the on-shell phase space for the internal particles, and that is how to take a diagram with disconnected edges and gluing two edges together. And this, if you just follow through the algebra of what the general definition is and see what it does to the image in the Grassmannian, it's fairly straightforward, and it's easy to define geometrically. What results from this, when you want to delete two columns, you want to delete two external particles, and so you're going to lower n by 2. And when you do that, you also lose one row. And the way that happens geometrically is you project every column of the matrix, every other column of the matrix, into the orthogonal complement of the sum of the two particles you're identifying. Now, of course, the sum of the two particles you're identifying, this operation, projecting into the orthogonal complement, has a GL1 redundancy. And so the volume form always loses one degree of freedom. The volume form there's a mod GL1 in this projection. So the result of this in this case would be a little 2x4 matrix like this. And you have 3 degrees of freedom. And those are the only, these two operations alone allow you to construct arbitrary, the C matrices for any graph. And the result is always something of this form. And if you include the appropriate numerator factors for every vertex with a theory without supersymmetry, this thing has got some it's got some prefactors that care about it. The volume form is built constructively, and these delta functions are completely universal. So you always can construct this representation. There's one more operation which I probably don't have time to talk about very much, but for those of you who know it, there's another nice thing you can do to a diagram, which is to add called a BCF bridge. Which starts with a diagram, and you add an edge, and it shifts a column by another column. And I'm not going to walk through the details here, in part because it's not sufficiently general operation. What I mean by that is that there are non-BCFW bridge constructible graphs for non-planar theories, but also because I just won't need it. But I do want to emphasize, because I'm going to draw pictures like this later on, that when you see a picture like this, the meaning of a bivalent vertex is just the identity. So you can just delete all bivalent vertices. So that's really the only thing you need to pay attention to. There's another way of constructing this correspondence, which I'm not going to motivate or derive for you, but it's much more efficient to put on a computer, for example, which is not to take a graph and to imagine it cut into little pieces and glue them together, but to just start from the graph in the first place. And that corresponds to the construction of the boundary measurement matrix. And I'm not going to derive this, but I just want to illustrate how this works, because it turns out to be very, very, it's a useful technological tool. So you imagine you want to compute this correspondence for a thing like this. Instead of building it up by gluing every little piece into each other, you could just start from the final diagram and decorate. And the first step in constructing this correspondence is to give this diagram a perfect orientation. And a perfect orientation is something where there's one arrow in for every white vertex and two out. And for every blue vertex, there are two in and one out. Okay, so you have to choose a perfect orientation. For a theory with maximum supersymmetry, it doesn't matter what perfect orientation you choose. You just choose one. Okay. And then you decorate the edges of the graph with variables. You can set a lot of them to 1, and I'm not going to tell you how to do that, but I've set all the ones to 1 that I can, so here's just a decoration. And now you construct the matrix by the boundary measurements, or basically all of the paths which go from the sink for the sources to the sinks. So what the matrix looks like is you have the identity matrix and all the outer edges that have that are sources. So 4, 5, and 6 are sources in this graph, so 4, 5, and 6 are the identity. And then to compute the entry of C1 in the C1-4, you just sum over all the paths between leg 4 and leg 1, and you multiply all the edges together. And you can do this weighting every single edge if you'd like. I've set a lot of those edge weights to 1. So in this case, there are two paths. There's just one is just alpha 5. And the other path gives you alpha 5 times alpha 8. So you get this entry of the matrix. For this thing, you go from 4 to 2, and you see that there's only one path from 4 to 2, and it's just got a single edge weight, so it's just alpha 2. And for here, you see there's only one path again, and it's just the product of all the edge weights. So starting from a graph with general edge weights, you can just construct this matrix very quickly. And it is a non-trivial fact that no matter how you perfectly orient this graph, the point in the Grassmannian, although the form of the matrix is going to be very different because it depends on what sources there are and what sinks there are and what paths there are, the point in the Grassmannian is the same for any perfect orientation. So you just pick one, it doesn't matter. This matrix is going to be GLK related to whatever other matrix you might get. And if you have a closed loop, you just do a geometric sum, a series. So I've not told you how to do this completely. Now the volume form for this in a theory with maximum supersymmetry is just the wedge product of all the edge weights. Couldn't possibly be simpler. And if you have any amount of supersymmetry, including no supersymmetry, but so n equals n super Yang Mills, this volume, the Grassmannian is the same. This matrix is identical, but what changes is the volume form. It gets a factor, the determinant of 1 minus the adjacency matrix for this graph raised to the power n minus 4. So the geometry of Onshell of these functions for non-supersymmetric theories is identical to the geometry of these Onshell functions for supersymmetric ones, just that the volume forms are different and therefore the functions are different because the volume forms depend on the orientation. Okay, so what I've described in the last couple slides is how to build this up constructively, how to take a general Onshell diagram and to write it in this kind of form. Just out of the building blocks that define, you know, that are uniquely fixed for any massless theory in four dimensions. So the general characteristics, n, this is some k by n matrix, and n is the number of external legs, obviously. K is the number of rows, and the number of rows is 2 rows per blue vertex and 1 row per white vertex, and you eliminate 1 row per internal line, so it's 2nb. I shouldn't have added trivalent because I'm not going to draw non-trivalent graphs in this talk. D is the number of coordinates in this volume form. So the number of coordinates is 2 per vertex minus the number of internal lines, because you have 1 GL, 1 redundancy per internal line. But on much more general grounds, it's easy to prove that it's equal to the sum of all the edges minus the number of vertices, the internal and external edges, which basically tells you that if you, this edge-weighted graph that you can set NV, the number of vertices, you can set one edge to the identity for every vertex. But anyway, this number of coordinates just depends on the graph, okay? And it's not generally equal to the dimension, okay? So it's the number of coordinates here. Notice that the number of delta functions couldn't care less about what the graph looks like. It's always 2k plus 2n minus k, so it's 2n delta functions in general. And after subtracting off the overall momentum conservation, it's always 2n minus 4. So there's always the exact same number of delta functions here. And notice that when k equals 2, this becomes 2 by 2 c dot lambda, and then this becomes 2 times n minus 2 of c dot lambda perp. But there's a unique c is now a 2-plane, and this tells you that c contains lambda. And that tells you that C is lambda as a 2-plane. So for MHV, for MHV amplitudes, when K equals 2, this whole Grassmannian story is just a very convoluted way of saying, of talking about lambda, because C is always equal to lambda. Okay. But there are some really important consequences of this, as I've already alluded to. One of them is that just notice that the dimension of the Grassmannian is fixed, it's bounded, right? It's K times N minus K. It's K times by N matrices modulo GLK so minus k squared. And this is an upper bound on the dimensionality of the submanifold that you're constructing. But the number of coordinates can grow arbitrarily with the number of internal edges. And that means that if you start drawing graphs with hundreds of internal edges, you're eventually going to exceed the dimensionality of the Grassmannian. As soon as that happens, this volume form becomes a degenerate volume form. And and that means that it becomes some degenerate prefactor times an irreducible volume form. And my statement about the finiteness of on-shell functions is really about the reduced ones, the ones for which these volume forms are non-degenerate. The other ones can all be built trivially as just these reducible prefactors. Okay. So the number of reduced diagrams is trivially finite for any n and k, for any process. So the number of graphs is finite, the number of these things is finite. Okay. Now I've only got 5 minutes left, and I want to actually get to the less trivial thing. So I'm going to skip over this part. So, okay, this is the last part of the talk, and I wanted to tell you what we know about more general quantum field theories beyond planar maximum supersymmetry. And basically, we know just a couple things. We don't know how to classify on-shell functions for MHV, but we know how to count the number of independent ones. And this was work with Freddy Cachazzo, Nima Arkani-Med, and Yaroslav Trenka, and Alex Posnikov maybe a year and a half ago or so. And anyway, there's a nice combinatorial classification for these functions, not for the functions, but for the graphs. And then there's a nice geometric proof to show you that that all of these functions are expandable into ordinary Park-Taylor tree amplitudes. So to all orders of perturbation theory, the coefficients of any polylogarithm are just Park-Taylors with various orderings, which is a very non-trivial fact. But it does not actually answer the question of how many functions are there. It tells you there's a basis of this size. Okay, so I'm going to skip over this. And I want to, because what I really want to get to is the first case where we really know the answer to the question, how many functions are there and what are the relations? And we did this by brute force. And we did it in the first non-trivial case for k equals 3 and n particles for G3-6. This is for six-particle NMHV. This is like the analog of the R invariants that occur in the coefficients of polylogarithms in Lance's papers, for example. So this is how many of these functions you would need to go to infinite loop order. And the basic idea is completely mindless. You'd basically draw all possible graphs and count how many varieties result. So you just construct them all and you just enumerate them. You just find their relations by brute force. It's not as trivial as it first appears, and it's not just because the number of graphs bounded by the number of internal edges is very large. For G3-6, the number of graphs is about 17 billion. Okay, so putting that on a computer is a little hard. But the real reason why it's complicated is not because of that. It's because we need to compare these varieties, and when n hat delta is not equal to zero, they're not just functions, not rational functions. They're either integrals or distributions, and it means it's very difficult for us to compare. We can't evaluate them. What we really need to do is see whether or not a diffeomorphism exists. And although even for a single diagram, there are many ways of constructing this boundary measurement matrix or building up this C matrix, and every way you do it differently results in a different set of coordinates. And so even looking at the exact same graph in different coordinate charts can be hard to compare. And so what we really want to see is if a diffeomorphism exists. And so unless we can constructively do this, it's very hard. So what I'm going to tell you on the next slide is how we did this in practice. And the key to the whole story is that for a graph with plane embedding, which means what I really mean is a planar graph with some ordering of the external edges, the answer for whether or not two varieties are equivalent or are related by diffeomorphism is very simple. You just ask which Plucker coordinates are zero. And if they have the same set, then they're equivalent. So as soon as you have a planar graph, checking equivalence is easy in any coordinate chart. You just evaluate it and look at whether or not the Pluckers are zero. But for the non-planar graphs, I don't have that kind of a test. And in the next slide, I want to show you how we built this. We used that as a recursive tool. So that relies on just a couple definitions and some conjectures. So the first is a definition we've already seen. A diagram is reduced if the dimension of the submanifold is equal to the number of coordinates, so if all the coordinates are non-degenerate, and of course it's the number of reduced graphs that are that. So, and it's worth pointing out that this is easy to implement in any coordinate or check in any coordinate chart, because all you do is just compute the rank of the tangent space in any coordinate chart. So D is a function of the graph, and this is easy to check. So dividing graphs into reducible and non-reducible ones is easy. So two varieties are isomorphic if there exists a volume-preserving diffeomorphism between them, but this can be a little hard to find. So let me just state some conjectures. This actually is important to our classification, but it's an interesting one, which is whether or not two isomorphic varieties, so if there exists a diffeomorphism between them, are the graphs related by a sequence of these moves or these moves? The first of these moves corresponds to what's called a cluster mutation in variables different than what I've defined for you already, but it doesn't really matter. And I can tell you that for all of the 17 billion graphs that we did in G36, this is true. So we didn't find any examples of, there are no cases where there are equivalent functions that are not related by these moves. But we have no idea how to prove that or even if it's true. Okay, so the next bit is really the computational powerhouse. And it's related, so the next thing to define is the boundaries of a variety. It's all the codimension one varieties. And if you remember that function for the D reduces when you delete an internal line. And so that means that if I want to get a lower dimensional variety, I look at a graph and I delete all possible edges. And then I ask the question, is the diagram reduced? If it's not reduced, then it has lower dimension than D minus 1. So I want to define the removable edges, or all the boundaries of this graph, by all the graphs obtained by deleting edges of this that result in codimension 1. So for this graph, for example, you just put it on a computer and you delete every possible edge, and you might find out that of all the edges here, every resulting graph is reducible except for these three. So that means that the boundary of this you can write as these three graphs, okay? Now, so this next conjecture is really the powerhouse of everything here, which is that two varieties are isomorphic if their boundaries are isomorphic. Okay, why is this a useful tool? It's because if you take enough boundaries, every boundary deletes an edge of a graph, and if you delete enough edges, eventually you get a planar graph. And as soon as you get a planar graph, we can test isomorphism directly. So the basic strategy is this: you take boundaries until you hit something planar or something with a plane embedding, and then you check isomorphism. And now so this recursively allows you to check isomorphism for all non-planar graphs, because every graph, if you delete enough edges, gives you a planar graph. Okay, so but for the purposes of counting things on the next slide, I want to define a couple more things, which is related to the title of the talk, of course. So this, by the stratification, I mean the graph that is generated by this, or the poset that's generated by these covering relations, or these boundary relations. So this is a graph of graphs. You take something, and this doesn't look like a diagram, but it doesn't matter. You take all of its boundaries, and then you take all their boundaries and all their boundaries, and you get a graph of graphs. So this is what I mean by the stratification. Because we don't have planarity, I don't actually care how legs are labeled, and so I don't actually care. I want to consider equivalence classes that are related by just relabeling of the legs and also changing colors of the vertices. So I'm going to call two varieties equivalent if they're just related by relabeling. And then the last conjecture is that two varieties are equivalent if and only if their stratifications are isomorphic as graphs. That's true for all of the 17 billion graphs, but I don't know how true it is more generally. This is if they're related by relabeling the column, so reordering the columns of the matrix or taking the orthogonal complement. Okay, so I don't have very much time left, but I want to just tell you what we found for this. When we started with the 17 billion things, how many inequivalent varieties did we find? Well, at top dimension, we found 24, only 24. These are dimension 9 things. And each one of these things is a source of some identity among these rational functions. These all have n hat delta equal minus 1, so they're all integrals over rational functions. I didn't tell you what that is. If you look at all of their boundaries with all of their permuted relabelings and everything like that, there are only 10 inequivalent on-shell functions. So there are only 10 functions that you need to construct the ratio function or the ratio function to infinite loop order. you might, in term, because these are equivalence classes, so it's 10 really times 6 factorial times 2, which is a big, big number. But it turns out that of all of those 14,000 different functions, only 3,000 of them are distinct. And because all of these things generate identities, it turns out that there are only 434 linearly independent functions, which is a statement that that's how many different kinds of R invariants you would need to write down to go to infinite loop order. And I'll skip, so anyway, in the paper you can see the details and pictures of every one of these these equivalence classes for arbitrary dimension, but I just want to end with some pictures, some pretty pictures. So the 24 top dimensional varieties, here are graph representatives for every one of them, and I hope you notice that I've drawn them in such a way that their construction as a sequence of bridges is obvious. There were two of them that were not bridge constructible, and so these are bridge constructible with extra particles, and you glue these two lines together. That's always true. It's always possible to start with a bridge constructible graph and start gluing legs, in part because if you cut enough legs, you get a planar graph. So you cut everything, and now you bridge construct the planar graph. Okay. For the functions that physicists really care about, these n hat delta equals zero functions, there are 10 of them, and these are what the representatives of each equivalence class look like. And it turns out the independent ones are just 1, 2, and unfortunately 5. All the other ones are expandable into these ones. So there are only three in equivalent, you only need to know 3 of them to generate all of them. Okay, so I'm now out of time, so I want to end this talk with where I started. There exists on very general grounds this correspondence between these onshell functions, which are cuts of loop amplitudes, or however you want to define them. These things are meaningful things that are gauge invariant for any theory in any number of dimensions whatsoever, but in 4 dimensions, with mass theories with massless particles, something magic exists, this correspondence, and it allows us to start tackling and to make sense of of some very important questions, to start counting these things. And so far, I mean, this counting that I just showed you for G36 is just scratching the surface. What we'd love to have is some combinatorial way of counting these things without doing this brute force construction. But in the absence of such mathematical understanding for how to classify these things, we can apply the same kind of brute force classification to general theories. In particular, I can do it for pure Yang-Mills and count how many different prefactors there are, things. And almost nothing is known about these things. But in the absence of the mathematical basis for these ideas, we can just do what physicists do and compute a bunch of things and learn about this space, generate theoretical data about the space of these functions in hopes that it will lead to a better understanding. So thank you very much.
Any comments, questions?
Yes, but I don't know how unique or distinct they are. I mean, so the way that, I hope you appreciated that every one of these graphs that we drew, all the representatives, are all generated from sequence of bridges, which means that if you embed this thing on the obvious Riemann surface, there's a permutation. So you can define the left-right path permutation for a graph embedded on any surface, and this is the permutation is corresponds to the sequence of transpositions on that surface. So they do have permutation labels, but the permutation label depends on the embedding, and I don't know what that dependence looks like, really. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I have it's not even in the paper, but we have a very good understanding of the subset of graphs which are not bridge constructible. And the bridge constructible ones are trivial to explore, so because you just build them up by sequences of transpositions. So the subclass of bridge constructible graphs is very nice, and we understand how. No, there are two exceptions. Yeah. Two exceptions. And I know how to count and identify the ones that aren't bridge constructible, but I don't have, I don't know how to count. I know how to generate them and, how to partition them off. Um, but how many there are, I don't know. Yeah.
Any more questions, comments? Okay, if not, you take a break until 3:30.
Thank you.